This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you as always. And you are listening to the show throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show on our website at horseracingradio.net. Well, to say that my guest on today's show has been well-traveled during his career in racing would be a gross understatement. The 43-year-old French-born, now California-based trainer was raised on his family's historic 200-acre stud farm in Normandy. He has spent time in Australia, in England, Singapore, and the United States, learning from some of the best in the business before finally deciding to make California his home in 2004. To date, he has saddled 166 winners with more than $7 million in purse earnings. Among those are four Graded Stakes victories, which came with three different horses. And we'll talk about each of those big wins and much, much more over the course of the next hour, including some of the unique and innovative ways he approaches his business. I think you're going to enjoy this. You might actually describe him as the Bryson DeChambeau of horse trainers. Please join me in welcoming trainer Leonard Powell, the Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Leonard, welcome, my friend.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. Can't wait to hear your story. And as I mentioned in that little open, it goes all the way back to your family's farm in Normandy. So I guess why don't we start there? Let's start at the beginning and take me through your story.
Yeah, well, you know, I was raised on a farm in Normandy about half an hour from Deauville. And my dad and my mom run the farm together. And my dad was a plough stock agent as well and a journalist. Actually, he was the correspondent for the daily racing form in France for a while in the early 80s. So, you know, as you can imagine, we were always talking about horses around the dinner family table.
I can imagine. Your dad, you mentioned that the ties that he had to horse racing, and of course we know the history of your family's farm. Tell me a little bit more about the farm and about some of the great horses that came through there.
Yeah, actually, you know, when we started, it was more flat horses, and then it developed into both flat and steeplechases. Steeplechase racing, as you must be aware, it's a lot more developed in Europe than it is in America. There's racing year-round, and the purses are about as equal as the ones on the flat racing. And there's a really big race in France called the Grand Steeplechase of Paris, which is the equivalent of the Grand National in England. And we've won that race three times. And over the flat, we've had some really good horses as well. There was a really good horse in the 80s that was trained by Charlie Whittingham in California, named Ness El Arab, that we bred for Mrs. Bryant. She's based in Middleburg, Virginia, but she's got quite a few horses in France with my dad. And so through the 80s, we had all those flat horses, and it's in the early 90s that we moved to steeplechase. And as a lot of people did in England, you know, when in the 80s, when the McToombs moved into the market, and they kind of did dominate the flat racing, a lot of people kind of concentrated on jump racing because that was the only way you could afford to have a nice horse if, you know, they were being put out of the market from the flat because of the involvement of the McToombs and then Coolmore later on.
How would you describe the farm itself, Leonard? I mentioned 200 acres, but how do you describe it to people when they ask you about it?
Well, it's very... it's quite old, especially in American standards. It's that, you know, the house is from the 18th century, and it's all made of lumber, and all the stables that are around the house are made out of lumber as well, and date from the 18th century as well. So it's very pittoresque, and we have about 60 to 70 mares on the farm. Now we have a second farm as well that actually, my dad doesn't run the farm anymore, my brother does. And I've got another brother, Freddy, that runs Arcana, which is the auction house in France. It's pretty much the Kinland of France. And so, as you can see, you know, I've got one brother that's a breeder, another one that runs the auction house, and I train here in California. So we kind of, you know, split it a ways. But now the farm's got 70, 80 horses. It's divided in two farms because, you know, we kind of outgrew the first farm. And in connection to my brother, we bought a second farm. And that's being used to break and raise the yearlings over there. So, yeah, actually my brother Richard is the one that runs the farm, and he's quite busy with all the mares.
That's one thing that I love about your story, Leonard, is that, you know, and there are so many fascinating elements to how you've gotten to where you are today, and we're going to talk about it over the course of the next 50 minutes here in the program, but the fact that this was always a family affair for you, for your father, for your brothers, and now for you with your children, you're carrying on that tradition, and the children are interested. We'll talk about that, but your brothers, growing up, I read that you were always big pedigree buffs. Is that true?
Yeah, actually. From when we were 8, 9, 10 years old, we used to love to study pedigrees. We could tell you, you know, the Northumbrian family 11, 12 generations away, and we were real pedigree buffs, my brothers.
Wow, and your dad, I assume, encouraged you to follow down that path?
Yes, very much so. You know, and he's as well, you know, he loves to study genealogy, and, you know, especially when he's during the mating season. But he very much so, and we used to go to the races with him on the weekends, and every school holiday was used, you know, to work on the farm and, you know, look at brochures. You know, we couldn't wait to receive the last blood horse when it was coming, and as soon as it got into the mail, we would just read it right away.
So many of the trainers that have appeared on this program over the years have started their careers as jockeys, or at least they tried to start their careers as jockeys. Some were successful, maybe more than others. You did the same thing. You started riding races, both steeplechase and flat races, back in France. Tell me about your riding days.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not much to remember of, because, you know, it wasn't very long, and, you know, there was a few folds involved as well. So, but there was a few winners, and, you know, there's a few things like your first winner. You'll always remember your first winner. I remember I was still in high school, and remember, you know, riding that horse in a province that there wasn't even a starting gate. You know, at the start with there was an elastic across the field, and that was the start of the race. And, you know, once you go past the wire first for the first time, it's quite a feeling that, you know, you really don't believe it. It takes a while to sink in. And I thought, you know, the experience of riding races was very important to me, especially, you know, you understand a lot more of what can happen in a race once you've ridden races.
Well, especially with steeplechase races, and I'm going to ask you the same question that I've asked other trainers who have ridden in steeplechase races early in their careers. Why on earth would anybody want to do that?
Well, you know, anybody that's done it knows why, because it's quite a thrill. And, you know, the thing I loved about steeplechase racing is that, you know, you go such a speed that, you know, it's not like show jumping or cross-country events where, you know, you can command a bit the horse and calculate his stride. There, you really got to trust your horse. And it's a real, real testimony of the trust between the rider and the horse, which is steeplechase racing, because if the horse, you know, takes off too early or comes up short there, you know, you're on your own. And And that's when you really have to trust your horse.
You said you always remember your first winner. I'm sure you remember a winner that paid well in excess of $240 to win, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Who was that horse?
The one that paid 240?
Yeah, I read that he was 120-1. Is that right?
Oh, was that? Yeah, that was the horse name. Oh, yeah, the big white face. The name escapes me right now. No, it was down the hill at Santa Anita, ridden by Kayla Straw.
Yeah, I was hoping that you would remember, because I was trying to find the name of the horse as I was getting ready for the show, and I couldn't find it, but it did say that one of your wins as a jockey was on a horse that was 120-1. And I said, well, that's one heck of an accomplishment.
Yes. Oh, as a jockey, you mean? Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
You meant as a trainer. No, as a jockey, yes, I remember that. And the funny thing is that, I mean, that was a long time ago. So it was a horse named Walico. And it was at Maison Lafitte. And I came from the back of the pack, and I came and won by half a length. And the horses that ran second, third, and fourth were all ridden by good buddies of mine. And they before the race, you know, we handicapped the race and we studied the race, and we actually put money together to do a trifecta. And we did a trifecta with the horse that ran in second, third, or fourth. And when I came on one, we blew our trifecta away.
Hey, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, I know. That was a long time ago. So now I can tell.
Visiting with trainer Leonard Powell here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, so when did you finally decide, Leonard, okay, riding's not going to be for me. There are other things in the business I want to do, like potentially training horses. You're still a young man at that point. When did you make that decision, and how did that come about?
Well, it was pretty much the weight, you know. It's that, you know, I was too heavy to run on the flat, and then the jumps, there was not that many opportunities for me there. So, and I mean, I always wanted to be a trainer, you know. And I mean, it started when I was 14, 15 years old, where on the school holidays, I used to go and ride out for different trainers and, you know, move a bit around Europe. And then as soon as I graduated from high school, I came to work for Richard Mandela in California for a year and a half. And my mom wanted me to go to university, but my dad thought I was a bit too immature to go to university on my own. So he said, you know, it's better that I go in the real world and know what is it to earn a paycheck. So he sent me to California, and those were really good years to be with Mr. Mandela, because 96, 97, I mean, this barn was loaded with good horses. We had Siphon, Sandpit, Gentleman, Taloir, Afternoon Delights, Sal of the Matter. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. That year, I always remember, is that we had $3 million races in California. We had the Santa Anita Handicap, the Hollywood Gold Cup, and the Pacific Classic. And Mr. Mandela ran 1-2-3 in all three of these races that year. So, I mean, the barn was loaded with Texas horses. And, I mean, that experience was amazing, especially at my young age.
Were you there the day that Darren Go upset Cigar?
Yes, yeah, actually. I just got, I was like fresh off the boat. I just gotten in California like 2 or 3 weeks before, and actually I had a winning ticket on Darren Go that day, so I was lucky. But Darren Go beat Cigar, and Siphon, I think, ran third or fourth that day. And that year we had a really good mare as well named Matiara that was owned by Mr. Halleckhead, and she was out of Most Precious and closely related to the stallion Malibu Moon now. But it was a very good time.
Yeah, I mean, and to learn from a guy like Richard Mandela as your first job here in the United States, I just can't even imagine what that must have been like for you as a young man trying to get your foot in the door. How did that relationship come about? How were you introduced to Richard?
Oh, actually, yeah, my dad had a client named Mr. François Fabre that had a really good filly back in the late 80s, early 90s, that was in training in America. I think the name was Gailey Bird. and she ended up in training with Mr. Mandela. So my dad had a relationship with Mr. Mandela for that horse.
Okay. So how much time now will you spend talking with Richard now that you're based in California?
Well, at first I was making myself very small and, you know, doing a small course. But Mr. Mandela is a great teacher. You know, he will take me on the side and explain me why we do this that way. And he was great. I stayed a year and a half over there, and it was an experience like no other.
I read a quote where you said that Mandela was tough, very tough. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was young at the time, so I probably needed somebody tough above me anyway. But he wanted things done the right way, you know, and his way. And I mean, he was tough, but he was fair. And you know, when you have a big barn like that, you need to be tough. You know, it's not a vacation camp.
Yeah, no, 100% right. Leonard Powell with me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. So after you spent time with Richard, where'd you go after that?
Well, actually, I had to do the army, because at the time the army was compulsory in France. So I had to go back home to do the army, and so because I was 20 years old, and then after the army, I fulfilled the wish of my mom, is that I attended university. So I got a degree in university, and I was still riding races at the same time. So it allowed me to, you know, to do university three or four days a week, and then ride out in the mornings and ride races on the weekend. So I did that for a couple of years, and that was until probably 1999, 2000. And once I got the degree, made my mom happy, then I left for Australia. And I thought, you know, I'd never been to Australia, and the racing, you know, was really on the up over there. And so I went over there to spend 2 years, and I worked for a trainer named John Hawkes. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he was a private trainer for the Ingham brothers. And actually, I just read this morning that one of them, Bob Ingham, passed away today. So, and they had a lot of horses, and they had about, you know, 200 horses in training. They owned a really good horse named Octagonal, and they had a really big breeding operation. And actually, when the McToombs, the Darley operation, got involved seriously with Racing Australia, they did buy the Ingham Brothers operation, which was Woodland Farms and Crown Lodge. So spent 2 years over there, great experience. You know, the training is quite similar to what we do in America compared to Europe. And it's a beautiful country too. People are very laid back, and the racing is a lot of fun over there. Even as a spectator, it was a lot of fun to go to the races over there. The public, you know, has got a lot of enthusiasm over there, and even the general public knows the horses, know the jockeys, know the trainers. So it's a lot of fun to follow racing over there.
What made the approach that John Hawkes takes when training horses, what made his approach different from the Richard Mandela approach of training horses?
Over there, you know, it's very different. They don't train the horses as fast in the morning. And, you know, here in America, you know, we always use a 12-second clip per furlong, you know, when we work horses. You know, you go 48, 49 for a half mile, or a minute and one for five furlongs. Over there, they go, you know, what we call a two-minute pace, which is 15 seconds per furlong. They call it even over there. And I found that it's a very good way to keep a horse fit, you know. And you don't need to drill them, you know, to the bottom every time you work them. And that's probably, you know, why we have so many injuries in America compared to over there. And but over there, so they don't work as fast, but they work more often. The horses will probably work twice a week over there. And but they do it in a slower way. And they use quite a lot of swimming over there too. And they swim the horses a lot, which is very beneficial for, you know, you don't have to carry the weight and a lot less pounding on the legs.
Yeah, he had a unique approach with two-year-olds too, didn't he?
Yes, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, they trained them really, really early. And, And, you know, a lot of people think, well, we got so many horses getting hurt because of the two-year-old, we go too early. But I think it's the opposite. You know, horses would get hurt in the future if you leave them dormant as a three-year-old, because the bone doesn't remodel. You need to stress the bone early. And, I mean, there's always a borderline. You know, it's a bit like a rubber band where you have to stretch it, but without breaking it. And over there, I mean, we used to receive the 3 years old in February, and I mean, that was Southern Hemisphere, so it'd be like receiving them in September or October here, in their yearling year. And, I mean, they were doing fast work, going to the gate, breaking from the gate. But what we did is that we did it just 2 weeks at a time. So we bring the horses in, and then we train them hard for a couple of weeks, and then we'll turn them out. And then 4 or 5 weeks later, bring them back in. And so, you know, we rotate them, the babies, like that. So it was enough to kind of get them used to the stable routine and stressing their body so it can develop and the bone can grow stronger, but without hurting them long term.
Yeah, you had said in an article I read that it's like a kid that misses preschool. It's very hard to catch up, and I thought that was a great analogy. Did you find, Leonard, that those two-year-olds, as they began their careers and started getting dressed, that they actually had fewer setbacks than horses that don't get stressed early?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, no, definitely. You know, they build stronger bone and ligaments. And I think, you know, they're stronger later. And the other thing that helps a lot in California is that, I mean, in Australia, sorry, is that they spell the horses, you know, twice a year. And, you know, that's a bit of the problem that we have in America, is that there's always another race, you know. Or you always look forward to the condition book coming out. And, you know, for a horse that's doing well, it's very hard to tell the owner, well, you know, let's give him a break now, because there's always an opportunity of a next race. While, you know, over there they work, you know, they've got spring racing and autumn racing. And usually in between the horses we go for a break, you know, from four to five weeks, which is enough time for the body to catch up without losing much fitness.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you bring up, the economic factor behind all of this. If you do have a horse that is doing well and you give them some time off, which you feel is the best approach, you have to be sure that you have an owner that is on board with that same philosophy and that the two of you are in lockstep together. Otherwise, it's just going to fall apart and it's not going to work. So how much time, Leonard, do you spend talking with owners when you start working with them and saying, hey, listen, here's my approach, here's how I like to do things, and here's what I think is best for the horse. Are you okay with it? How much time do you spend?
I talk at least once a week, you know, it depends. You know, if the horse is running, and, you know, we'll talk a bit more often, you know, we'll talk prior to entry day, and then once we've seen the entries, we'll discuss the race. But usually at least once a week, you know, let the owner know how the horse is doing. And, you know, Santa Anita is a great place for people to come and visit as well, because the mornings are beautiful. And so owners come quite often on the weekends, and it's very nice to have them at the barn.
So after you got finished working in Sydney with John Hawks, where did your journey take you next?
So, yeah, my visa was about 2 years over there. So once my visa expired, I took a flight home, and my flight was stopping in Singapore because, you know, there was a layover. And I had a very good friend that was a jockey over there named Oliver Deleuze. So I decided to spend a couple of days over there, and he introduced me to his trainer, Michael Kent, which is a great trainer. He's based now in Australia, but... after a couple of days, Michael offered me a job, so I ended up staying 6 months in Singapore. And I liked it over there. You know, it's very insular. You know, we race once or twice a week, and, you know, it's always the same horses going around. So the racing is okay. I mean, it's not that much fun, but the area was great. I was with my girlfriend at the time, which is now my wife, and we quite ended up, you know, traveling around Asia and visiting Malaysia and Borneo and Thailand on my weekends off over there. So, After the 6 months in Singapore, Michael got offered a job in Macau, and he offered me a job over there as his assistant trainer, and you know, told me, you know, Macau was going to be the a stepping stone to go to Hong Kong later on, and you know, racing in Asia, as you must be aware, it's, you know, it's quite phenomenal. So I took his offer, and he told me that it was going to take a while to get the visa. So in the meantime, I went home to work at the farm and work on the plow stock with my dad. And after 2 or 3 months and still no visa, decided to come back with Mathilde, my wife, to California just to visit some friends, because you know, I had a great experience when I was with Mr. Mandela, and I told her, well, once we get the visa, we'll go straight from California to China. And that was in 2001, and I'm still waiting for that visa, so never came.
Well, you know, Michael Kent's approach was somewhat unique. He used science in a lot of his different training methods and the way that he would work with horses. And in the beginning of the show, I described your approach as maybe being similar to what we see with U.S. Open golf champion Bryson DeChambeau, where he has a very analytical and a different way of looking at golf. I think Michael Kent took that same approach when he was training horses, didn't he?
Yes, no, definitely. You know, Michael was, you know, he had a very scientific way to look into training. And there's a book written by Alan Davey. It's called A Scientific Approach to the Training of Thoroughbred Horses. And it's very interesting, you know, because, you know, there's always, you know, the old school of training horses where, you know, you look at them and then you see, you know, when their coat looks good, and you say they're ready to run. But, I mean, there's a lot more to that, you know. Yeah, and it really studies the aerobic and the anaerobic capacity of each horse. And, you know, we'll study the lactate level of each horse and we really monitor their heart rate when they train or when they come back from the track or even after the race. And it can teach you a lot about the horse, you know, especially if you train a horse too hard. You know, that approach can really show you when you need to take the foot off the pedal before a serious injury comes.
He is trainer Leonard Powell. He is my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Believe it or not, we have to get to this bottom of the hour break. That first half of the show flew by. We will continue this visit in the second half of the show right after this. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
From America's number one auction company by percentage of Grade 1 winners sold, including these selected yearling graduates: Bast, Four Wheel Drive, Honor AP, Perfect Alibi, Rushing Fall, Sharing, Speech, and Tis the Law, comes an unprecedented showcase of quality. 662 selected yearlings in one extraordinary catalog. The Fasic Tipton Selected Yearling Showcase, September 9th and 10th after the Derby in Lexington, Kentucky.
The test of time. There is no better example than Mill Ridge Farm. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, this year's inductee into the Hall of Fame as a pillar of the turf. Since 2000, Mill Ridge has raised or sold 35 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners and 2 Horses of the Year, nearly 2 per year. If you're looking for success in the thoroughbred business, consider Mill Ridge Farm and its consulting arm, Nicoma Bloodstock, for it is proven and tested over time.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Fate Albert in the orange making ground, and then Miss Payne Tour. They are coming to the top of the lane now, and it's Ollie's Candy on the outside taking on Miss Bad Behavior. Ollie's Candy, Miss Bad Behavior. They are stride for stride. California Gold Rush running on late. Fate Albert down the center. Fate Albert is coming fast on the grandstand side. Fate Albert, Ollie's Candy. Fate Albert catching stride for stride. Fate Albert perfectly timed up to win it. Fate Albert to Ollie's Candy. California Gold Rush was third.
Well, Trevor Denman with a call. Fatal Bear getting the victory in the Grade 1 Del Mar Oaks. That was back in 2018. Fatal Bear, trained by my special guest here on Trainer Talk. That is Leonard Powell, and I'll continue this visit momentarily, but do want to welcome everybody back and remind you that if you did miss any portion of the show, all you have to do is head back to our website. You can listen to this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure at horseracingradio.net. You can also do it Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, so lots of ways to be able to access your HRN programming, not just live, but on podcasts as well. So head over there, horseracingradio.net, and follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Leonard, that day when Fatale Bear crossed the line first in the Del Mar Oaks, giving you your first Grade 1 victory as a trainer, that had to be extremely special for you.
Yeah, no, it was very special. It was very nice. It happened at Del Mar, and all the owners were there, and especially like the build up for the race was quite challenging because she had run on July 4th weekend in Belmont, in the Belmont Hawks, and she had a bleeding episode that day. She bled pretty much nearly a 4 out of 5. It was like between a 3 and a 4 out of 5 that day. And after that, I sent her to Bruce Jackson in Fairhill so she can do the hyperbaric chamber. So she wasn't being trained over there. She was just going to the chamber. And I couldn't get a flight back to California until pretty much August 1st. So she spent, you know, more than 3 weeks just walking and not doing much. And the race, I don't remember the exact date, but I'm pretty sure it was around August 20, 21st, 22nd, something like that. So I had only 3 weeks to get her ready for the Oaks, and it's not like I could train her hard ever because she's a filly that was prone to bleeding. So it's not like I was going in there full of confidence. There was plenty of question marks. So when she won, it was more of a relief than anything else.
Yeah, she was 7-1 that day. She got up and she won by a neck, and you didn't care. It could have been a nose or a nostril. It wouldn't have mattered. The result was the same. And to see her do that after everything she had been through, what's that like for a trainer when you see your pupil, if you will, perform like that on a big stage like that?
Well, I say the first sensation that comes, it's relief. You know, it's a relief that you've done a good job with your team, and it all came to fruition. And then, you know, the sensations came, you know, and especially, you know, I had one of my youngest daughter on my lap during the race, so that was quite a joy to be able to share that with my daughters, you know, and my wife, who was a part owner of the house, of the horse as well, so that was the cherry on top.
That's something that you've always been big on. You want to make sure that you have some skin in the game with a lot of the horses that you train.
Yeah, it helps a lot to make the right decisions, I found, you know. And once, you know, you don't need to own a big chair, you know, because, you know, you still want, a bit of money coming in to pay the bills. But usually I like to get, you know, between, you know, a quarter or a third of the horse. And the one thing I've found out is that once you own a piece, I mean, it's a lot easier for everybody because, you know, the owners trust you a lot more and they know that you're going to do what's best for the horse and for them as well. And because, you know, it's your own interest as well. And all the decisions that come to for the career of the horse are a lot easier to take when the trainer owns a piece of the horse.
Well, Fatale Bear was certainly special. I mean, that Grade 1 win, I know, is always going to be something that you're going to remember for the rest of your life. But the year before, you saddled her in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies Turf. That was in 2017 at Del Mar. She ran a pretty good fifth that day as a big long shot in that field. Was that your first Breeders' Cup experience, Leonard?
No, actually, it was my second. I had a horse. He was a calbred named Eoteroa. And he won first time out, and paid a big price. And my owner had quite a big ticket on him, and Mr. Paul Viskovich. And it's quite a funny story because then I ran him back at Del Mar in a Calbred Stake, and he didn't run very good. He went fourth, And I was going to run him on Breeders' Cup weekend. There's always a Calbred Stake going a mile on the dirt. So I was going to run him in there, and I wanted to prep race for the, for that mile on the dirt, because he had never run beyond 6 furlongs. So I ran him in the Zuma Beach, which was 1 mile on the turf. I thought he could go on the turf because he was by Good Journey, which is the son of Nureyev. And in that race, my good friend Patrick Biancone had a horse named Diamond Bachelor in the same race. And Diamond Bachelor was undefeated at the time. And Patrick told me for the race that I shouldn't run in there because his horse would destroy mine. And I ended up beating Patrick. So,
gee, good friend, huh? You shouldn't run in there because my horse is going to crush yours.
Yes. But so anyway, we ended up winning Zuma Beach, which is the local prep here for the Breeders' Cup. Aotora was not nominated for the Breeders' Cup, so it was costing $120,000 to run him in there. So it was quite a big question to know if we were going to supplement him or not. And the week before the deadline to nominate the horse into the Breeders' Cup, Paul Viskovic hit a pick six for $120,000. So for us, it was like an omen that we should run him in there. And I think he ran sixth that day. He kind of split the field, and he ran a good race. And he's a horse, that's a testimony of a horse that, you can run early as a three-year-old, as he made his debut as a July of his two-year-old year. And I think now he's 8 or 9 and he's still running. On the lower circuit, he's at Golden Gate, but he's still competitive at a certain level.
You know, Leonard, you talk about the owners and the folks that are placing wagers on the horses and, multi-leg wagers and all these types of things. And at the core, that's one of the things that drives this sport is the gambling aspect of it. Are you a trainer that will have a wager on your horses every now and then?
Actually, I never bet on my horses. And, as I tell people, the bet I make is when I enter them. That's my bet, when I put them into a race, that they're going to perform well. And I never bet on my horses. The way I see it is that if they win, I'm happy enough that a winning ticket is not going to change enough. And if I don't win, I'm already down. And to have lost money on top of that would put me in a certainly bad mood for my wife and my kids when I get home.
Well, and since you brought up your good friend Patrick Biancone, he gave you some advice at one point telling you that when you train, you just can't do it like everybody else. You have to do something different. So what is different about the way that Leonard Powell trains a racehorse?
I think, we spend a lot of time with them. I spend a lot of time, walking the barn area, I still ride some of my horses, and if I'm not on a racehorse, I'd be on the pony. And with my riders, we spend a lot of time on the horses, and a set will last at least 40 to 45 minutes. And I think it's very important, for the mindset and for the health as well, to spend as much time as possible outside of the stall.
Yeah, you're big with the walking part of it too, aren't you?
Yeah. No, I think walking, a lot of people think that, walking a horse is a way to get from A to B, but actually, to me, it's a training tool. You can keep a lot of fitness by walking, if you walk enough time, and it's very good for the mind as well to be interactive, with a human being, and knowing that, you're not going to be pounding on the racetrack.
Well, let's spend a little time talking about a couple of the other horses that brought you graded stakes success, and that's first and foremost Niagara Causeway, who won the Grade 3 Tokyo City Handicap all the way back in 2008. What do you remember about that day?
Yeah, no, I remember it was a very, very close photo finish, and took them a while to announce the winner. I don't remember the horse that went second. I just remember he was trained by Mike Mitchell, which was a trainer that excelled at training horses at the distances basis. and it was on synthetic, and we broke the track record that day going a mile and a half. And but he was a Nagara was a horse that I got from Patrick Biancone when he had his suspension, and for Mrs. Glenda Perryman, which is a great owner. She runs at the La Bahia Stud, and she's based in Texas, and she's an extraordinary lady that has been very very loyal to the barn for all those years. And but Nagara, yeah, he was a horse. He was quite strong to train in the morning. And but as a lot of giants goes away, he just got better with age.
Did you think at that point that you'd have to wait 10 years to win another graded stakes race?
Well, no. I mean, no. You once you win one, you always look forward to the next one. But we didn't have the horses for at the time.
Yeah, you came back in 2018, 10 years after the first one, with Beachview, who won the Grade 3 Cougar the Second Handicap. Tell me about that one.
Same, mile and a half on the dirt, and the son of Giants goes away as well. And he's a horse he could run all day. Some of my owners, Levy Racing, of Mark and Paul Levy, they bought the horse for Winnie Ebanks from Gary and Mary West. And the horse was in training with Jason Service back east. And from what I understand, they thought that he was a turf horse, and Mr. and Mrs. West are not very interested in turf horses, so they decided to sell him. We bought him privately, and we did very well with Beachview. We, right away, he won the first condition allowance, then the second condition allowance. And then I had a small issue with suspensory, so I had to give him time off. And then when we brought him back, I ran him in the San Marcos, I think, which was mile and a quarter, and he ran a good second. And then I ran him in the Cougar Handicap. That was his first race on the dirt in a while for me. But I thought, you know, the surface wasn't an issue with him, it's as long as the distance. Could be good for him, and same son of James goes away. They just get better with age and stamina type of horse.
Talking with trainer Leonard Powell here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. He is on a roll, to say the least. His horse is running extremely well, and the past couple of years have been very, very good for him. We talked about the stretch from 2008 to 2018, where, as Leonard said, just didn't have the horses to compete in those graded stakes races consistently. He was still winning races, but not at the clip that he is now. Last year, Leonard, you saddled 26 winners, nearly $1 million in purse earnings for the year, your best year to date. What was the key to taking things to a whole nother level?
Well, better horses, you know. That's it. You know, I love that quote of Jack Van Berg. You know, when they ask him, you know, when he started doing, you know, really well with better horses, he said, you know, what did you do different, Jack? He said, well, I've got a different feeding program. He said, oh, what did he say? Well, I'm feeding better horses. And I thought that's a great quote. And it's all about the horses, you know. It's not, I don't train a good horse different than a bad horse. It's just, you know, what you have in the barn is what matters.
One thing that I loved about your story through all my research, Leonard, was the fact that, you know, we talked earlier about your different approach with some things and the people that you learned from who had different approaches that seemed to be successful. And there's no right or wrong way necessarily to train a racehorse. It's taking care of the horse and putting the horse first and then making sure that you can continue to have success in that fashion, but everybody does it a little differently. But one thing that I loved is that you have this appreciation and love for the true fundamentals of the sport, the true fundamentals of the game. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, no, I mean, you know, it's all about the horses, you know, and this is why, you know, as I say, you know, mostly every time you win a race, you know, the first sensation that comes is relief that, you know, you didn't mess it up, because, you know, it's most of the time we come in the way of horses, and we do mistakes that kind of, you know, hinder the development, and the one thing you want to make sure every day is that is that you do everything the right way, treat the horse right, so he can fulfill his abilities.
Earlier, you talked about your daughter sitting on your lap when you won that Grade One back in 2018. You have three daughters, if I'm not mistaken, and all of them somewhat interested in the sport.
Yeah, the first two were now in their teenage years, and they're quite busy with school. They have long school days, so they'll come out on the weekends, but they're not as involved. The last one, her name is Jeanne. And she's very enthusiastic about it. Very enthusiastic.
Does she work with you in any way?
Yeah, I mean she's only 10 years old, so this year it was very sad because she couldn't come to the barn area at Del Mar. But last year she would come every day, and she'd come in the morning with me, and then she rides with. A trainer named Amy Hess, which is Bob Hess' ex-wife, and she goes to the show park and rides English over there. But and she still does that on the weekends. But she loves to watch the races. She loves to play with her horses at home, and it's fun to share that, you know, with your kids.
Yeah, come on, Dad, get her out to the barn. 10 years old, she's old enough to muck a few stalls.
I know. The only problem at the moment, it's 8-year-old personal only, and I haven't been able to let them convince them that she's essential to my operation yet.
Leonard Powell here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. You're still living down by the old Hollywood Park in that area, right?
Yeah. We live in West Hollywood. The reason is that my daughters go to a French school that's on the west side of L.A., so if I was to live close to Santa Anita, which is on the other side of Los Angeles, as you can be aware, the commute wouldn't be much fun for my wife. So decided to still live on the west side, and I commute every day. But I come to work at 4 o'clock in the morning, so traffic is not an issue.
Yeah, your wife, you met her at university, and has just been an amazing relationship. And so many trainers will come on this show and talk about how important it is to have somebody as their significant other, their wife, their girlfriend, whatever it is, that understands the true commitment that it takes to be a horse trainer. So how important is that, Leonard?
Yeah, no, it's very important, especially for my wife. It was quite hard when the kids were young and we didn't have any family here. When you're a young mother and you have three kids at home, it's always nice to be able to go to your sister or your mom and get a bit of a break. And me, I work every day of the week, so I'm not much help in that matter. And so it was quite hard for her, to be alone. After a while, you kind of feel as a slave to your children. But I mean, I help as much as I can, and I go and pick them up at school a couple of times a week, and on the weekends, they'll come with me to the barn. But now it's quite hard for a wife, for a trainer's wife, not to have me on the weekends or on pretty much. Sometimes she might enjoy that I'm not there, but
but there are things that in this job, much like, say, an athlete who is competing on the weekends and has an extended season, there are things that you miss on the family side. You'll miss some of the things that your daughters get involved with because you have to be working. You have to be at the track on the weekends when a lot of the things that they're doing are taking place. Can that wear on a trainer after a while, Leonard? Can it be kind of hard?
Yeah, it is, but let's see. I mean, personally, I try to make, I don't have any hobbies outside of work, I don't do anything. I don't play golf, I don't fish, I do nothing. The only thing I do is go to barn, work, and then go home, and then enjoy my kids. So I'm pretty lucky that I spend quite a bit of time with them. And, in California, we're lucky that we only move once a year to Del Mar, and that's during the school holidays. So they come down with us. And it's not like, you know, on the East Coast where you have to choose between New York or Florida to raise a family. And some of the trainers, you know, they don't get to see their kids for 2 or 3 months at a time because they have to attend school in another state. So I think California, we're pretty lucky in that matter that, you know, the downtime is Del Mar, and most of the time the kids are down there with us, and we can enjoy the beach, lunchtime between the training and the races.
Yeah, well, considering what you just said about not having any other hobbies, that horse racing is really it for you. You landed in a great situation with Richard Mandela, because as you were saying that, I was thinking back to when Richard was on this show 5 or 6 or 7 years ago now, and I asked him what other things he enjoyed doing outside of racing, and I can remember there was a pause, and then he said something that this is it. There is nothing else. This is what I love. This is what I do. And it sounds like you're cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, no, I mean, very much so. I mean, my wife finds it a bit annoying that I don't do anything else. but to me, is that, you know, you don't take a day off, because what I'm going to do in my day off, you know, sometimes, I mean, once or twice a month, what I'll do is that I'll come into the barn a bit later just so I can have breakfast with the kids. That's something that's a bit special. It's a special family moment, and I like to do that once or twice a month. It's just have breakfast with the kids and take them to school, and then I'll come to the barn. And that's something that, you know, as you said, you know, it's something that you cannot go back to later on. So I make a special effort to do that a couple of times a month. It's just wake up with them, you know.
How about a family vacation? Does that ever happen for you guys?
Yeah, we do it maybe once every 2 or 3 years, but, you know, it's very hard to get away for a week or 10 days. And we went to Costa Rica a couple of years ago, and we loved it. It's a beautiful country. Next year we might go for a week away just before Christmas. You know, there's no racing in California pretty much from December 15 to Boxing Day, which is December 26. So I might take a week, but every winter I'll take 2 or 3 days off just to go skiing with the kids. You know, we go to Mammoth, which is 4 or 5 hours away. And because my wife doesn't ski, so if I want my kids to be able to ski, I've got to go. So,
yeah, Leonard Powell here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Leonard, we're down to about the final 3 or 4 minutes of the program. Are there any horses that I haven't mentioned yet that we haven't talked about that when you think back on your career, you say, boy, that's a horse I am never going to forget?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's one that's got to come to my mind right away, Soifet. I mean, Soifet is a horse, we claimed him for $16,000, and he made over $1 million for us. And he was such a classy horse. He's now with Michael Bowen and at all Friends Farms, and he lives a great life over there. But I mean, one of the proudest moment of our barn, I think, is when Soifet won the Crystal Water Stakes at Santa Anita by a nose at 50-1, and he was the first 10-year-old to win a stakes race in at Santa Anita. And I mean, as you can imagine, Santa Anita, it's got a lot of history, and to be the first 10-year-old to win a stakes race and to be able to compete at the top level like that was quite an achievement for us, and we were so proud of him. And the whole backside was so proud of that horse. I mean, the day after, usually the day after they run, I always take the horses out either for a jog or for a pony, just to get the lactic acid out of them and stretch their legs out. And the whole backside was full of pride for Soifet. And, you know, it's very rare to see everybody in the backside happy that you won a race. And that was the fact that they, when Soifet won the Crystal Water.
That is one of the things that I feel is often lost in our sport, that we don't necessarily do a good job of letting people know about. The fact that, yes, you're competing against each other, but the backside is a very tight-knit community, and everybody at one point or another kind of goes through this journey together. And the people that are involved with getting a horse to the races, it's not just about Leonard Powell, the trainer. There are a whole bunch of people that are cheering for that horse for a variety of reasons that have had their hands on that horse before they even get to the racetrack that make this sport possible.
Yeah, no, it is definitely a team effort, you know. And you know, it's very nice to see, you know, the pride in the backside workers when they have a horse that runs well or wins a race, and you can see it in their eyes. And you know, it's not a glamorous job, you know. We wake up early in the morning to pick up manure, and you know, it's not much fun as a day-to-day thing. And you know, but once the horse delivers. And as I say, you know, the first feeling that comes when a horse wins, it's relief that you did a good job, and then you can take a step back and be thankful for all your staff that puts in the day-to-day green.
Yeah, well, Leonard, you have done such a great job with so many horses over the years, and we can be thankful that we have trainers like you that put the horse first and continue to do right by the horse before they even think about anything else. And listen, continued success, my friend. I can't thank you enough for spending a little time and telling your story here on Trainer Talk tonight. All the best moving forward, and we will look forward to catching up again down the road.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, trainer Leonard Powell here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Wow, interesting story, interesting life. I mean, he's only in his mid-40s, and he's been to all these different countries. He's experienced so many different facets of the sport, and he continues to just get it done day in and day out. Fantastic stuff. If you missed any portion, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this program, all of our Trainer Talk shows. Follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and Instagram. Well, for my special guest, Leonard Powell, for my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.